Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. In less than 3 months, the West Ukraine narrative has been turned on its head. Ukraine is not winning, it's steadily losing. The West is not unified. In fact, divisions are widening. The Russian economy is weathering massive sanctions. Western economies are in trouble. Who will blink first? Crosstalking sanction regimes. I'm joined by my guest, Matthew Ehret, in Montreal. He is a senior fellow at the American University in Moscow and director of the Rising Tide Foundation of Canada. In New York, we have Richard Wolff. He is professor emeritus of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and author of The Sickness is the System. And in Auburn, we cross to Lou Rockwell. He is the founder and chairman of the Mises Institute. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let me go to Richard first in New York. Richard, over the past week or so, the narrative, Western narrative, enforced narrative, I'd like to point out, on Ukraine is shifting. We have the Washington Post and the New York Times. We had Henry Kissinger, not to someone I usually quote, in Davos, said the same. And then General Milley, the postmodern chief of staff of the United States military, he's even said there must be a negotiated end. Nonetheless, the European Union has rolled out its sixth round of sanctions here. So, Richard, it seems like the sanction regime is turning into the cure is worse than the disease here, because if they're not going to get the political outcome they want, but the global South is suffering, and for the first time in a long time, Western polities and citizens and consumers are feeling the pinch of a foreign policy that is just not very well thought out, apparently. Richard.
Well, I think that the most important of the people you mentioned in terms of what he said, and I'm surprised by it too a bit, was Mr. Kissinger, because what he pointed out, basically, if you read between the lines, was that while the Europeans, for their own domestic political reasons, need to keep up the game, here in the United States, where the game is directed from, there's already a rethinking going on. It's not about whether this is a war they want to pursue. I think they still want to do that. But how to do it, under what circumstances, and with what accompanying words and verbiage, that's being questioned and changed. And in my own judgment as an economist, I would have to say to you, we have learned here in the United States, if we're even half awake to what's going on, that Mr. Trump levied the mother of all sanctions against China for a set of objectives, pretty much every one of which was not achieved. Now we're doing this under a new government against Russia, and we're basically experiencing this unpleasant lesson once again. And I think that's the basic reason why you're beginning to sense shifts in figuring out what to do next.
You know, Lou, along the same lines here, I mean, I live in Russia. I'm watching these sanctions. At this point, it's only been 3 months, but it's been quite limited from what I can see, what my lived experience, except for we don't have access to the global financial system, which might be a good thing in the long run. We'll see how that works. But, you know, Lou, I mean, the Western economies are suffering. They were suffering before Russia's military campaign in Ukraine, and it's only gotten worse here. So what is more important, your own citizens and consumers, or a feel-good approach that, you know, we have to beat the Russians, Putin can't win? Well, that mantra is demonstrating that Western consumers and citizens can't win also. Lou.
Well, it sure is, and of course, what we see going on there is the destruction of the American economy. It's quite something. See it, and of course, what Biden is doing in terms of inflation and all the he's just doing everything wrong. He's done everything wrong since he came to office, and I think this is good for the American. It's good. I hate to say this for the American people, since I'm one of them, but I think it's good for the American people to understand what's happening to them, why it's happening. That it's the U.S. government, it's Biden, the Congress, and the rest of the creeps in Washington who are destroying us, and this needs to stop. And really, in the long term, of course, the war, the U.S. should not be putting on this war. And that's a terrible thing, too. But it would be great to just see the U.S. government step back, Milley, all these people. They're nothing but they're monsters, and they need to be reined in. And I think that's happening. I think more and more Americans are realizing what's going on here. That when Biden told them that they were going to suffer for the sanctions on Russia, well, of course, there's been huge suffering, and that's getting worse. And I think this is actually a good thing. This is going to happen, continue to happen.
Matthew, Lou used the word creeps. I used the word ghouls. Okay, but I basically the same thing here. I mean, this $40 billion package for Ukraine, all in, it's about $53 billion. It's a lot of welfare for the military-industrial complex. Actually, very little of it will actually end up in Ukraine. But nonetheless, I mean, going into debt, printing money you don't have, and there's been no real debate. I mean, these ghouls in Congress didn't even debate it. I mean, they didn't even read it, okay? I mean, there's been a lot of spending going on, a lot of waste, but there's always something. $40 billion could go to a good cause. And I can tell you that $40 billion is not going to a good cause, at least not to people that deserve it. Go ahead, Matthew.
No, absolutely. And it really indicates, I think, an insanity embedded in the system, which is at the heart of the current breakdown, because underlying this entire race for chaos in Ukraine and the geopolitical manipulations is the breakdown of an entire system that was really shaped with the detaching of the US dollar from the gold reserve system back in 1971 and floated, which resulted in a consumer society cult. And the increasing detachment of the monetary system, the financial system, from the physical productive system, so that we can create debts increasingly over the past 30, 40 years that are so detached from anything that has value that we don't realize that, yeah, you know, $45, $50 billion, that's nothing. We've already spent trillions of dollars just inflating zombie banks that are, we're told, too big to fail. They already collapsed in 2009. We've been kicking the can down the road. And like you said, if you put this, even a fraction of those trillions, into something that is not bombing countries in the Middle East, where you spent, I think, $9 trillion or something on just destroying the Middle East since 9/11, and just paying for unnecessary wars in Ukraine, you'd be able to invest it in things that produce real wealth, things like the Belt and Road Initiative, things that Russia wants to do right now with the Greater Eurasian Partnership that involves creating real wealth with, a fraction. You could end world hunger several times over. So it's a lack of priorities on a very high degree.
Well, Matthew, along those lines there, I mean, I don't know if you know, if you've been observing the Russian ruble that was actually absolutely shattered in the first few weeks of the conflict. And now it is one of the strongest currencies in the world. And it's because of commodities. It's backed up by real things. It's not a printing press. It's grain. It's wheat. It's oil. It's real. Okay. Richard, let me go to you here. I mean, I've talked to you a number of times, and it seems to me that this war in Ukraine is just another reason not to address the real problems that have been the American people and Western world has been experiencing for the last 40 to 50 years. They've come up with still another excuse why the system doesn't work for the vast majority of people. Richard.
Yes, well, I don't see it as much of a break. Let me explain why. I think you have, and I'm exaggerating, but I want to make a point, you have offset the internal problems of this economy, which are getting larger and larger, pretty much along the lines of the growing gap between rich and poor, which is now quite extreme and has become more so over the last 30, 40 years. And you're seeing, likewise, the threat of the rise of the first real economic competitor of the United States in a century, namely the People's Republic of China. Those two things are frightening. Those two things are not being amenable. They're not amenable to domestic policy in terms of the economy here. They were not amenable, Mr. Trump's effort to stifle Chinese growth over there. One of the few areas where this political group can see something that isn't frightening is in the ability to lead NATO, weak as it is, to expand, to the east, which is an old fantasy and dream ever since the end of World War II, to undo the arrangements that were made then. And Ukraine is, in a way, a kind of epitome, a final chapter, if you like, yeah, of this one area of quote-unquote good news, they hoped. And I think that's part of the reason why they went in as intensely as they did, precisely because all the other venues for them to make a progress have been shut down for them.
Yeah, Lou, it's been quite bizarre watching the Western response, particularly the Europeans. I mean, it's baffling how they're destroying their own productivity and the lives of their citizens, energy prices, food prices, and all this, just for something that has had no geopolitical or economic value to them whatsoever. I think future economists will be baffled by this. Go ahead, Lou.
Well, they're, of course, taking the orders of their bosses in the U.S., as they always do. And as Ron Paul pointed out a number of times, NATO should have been abolished a long time ago. And I think we see right now just what a disaster it is, what a criminal disaster it is, and it's what it's doing to the peoples of Europe, what it's doing to everybody else in the world. It's a terrible operation. And I hope that that's going to end. We'll see if it does. But I think that the NATO is much undermined. That's excellent. We'll see if it's underlined sufficient to have it abolished, because that's what we really need.
Well, it's very interesting because as the alliance may expand, it shows to me its weakness, and the U.S. is handing out security guarantees like candy. They will have to come to terms with that, and certainly in the Pacific, as Richard has been mentioning China a number of times, when you hand it out too many times, then you become a hostage to it. I'm going to jump in here, gentlemen. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on sanction regime. Stay with RT.
Since the breakaway of the Donetsk People's Republic, war's been raging in Donbass. Ukrainian artillery's been shelling civilian towns and mining villages there.
Прильот! Вот! Дым! Возле нас прилетело! Прильот! Вот он, прильот! Ну что, вы видели все своими глазами? Прилетело буквально 50 метров от нас, взорвалось Д-30. Слава богу, осколки не в нас полетели. Валим.
We need to counter the Russian state-controlled narrative.
Als Teil der Sanktionen gegen Russland gehen die westlichen Länder gegen russische Auslandssender vor.
Mais écoutez, monsieur, c'est pas à vous de décider de qui est journaliste ou pas dans ce pays. On est en France, quoi, c'est pas possible.
We will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
RT, Sputnik, even our video agency, roughly, all banned on YouTube.
Et merci à vous tous pour votre fidélité et votre soutien.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing sanction regimes. Okay, gentlemen, I want to set up something, and I want us all three to discuss it here. At the very core of all of these things here, I mean, there's geopolitics involved here, obviously minimizing Russia's influence on the global stage, the, you know, the neocon argument and all this, and there's the China element as well. But at the very core of it, at least here and now, it's all about energy. And one of the curious things is that what they want to do is Russia garners a lot of wealth because of its energy exports. That's obvious. The European Union wants to turn it off because they're saying that's how Putin funds his war here. But we also have the Green New Deal and Build Back Better. And this has turned into, and this is my opinion and we can discuss it, it's turned into an opportunity to kind of accelerate this Green New Deal by saying they don't want certain countries' energy, but they don't want any fossil fuel at the end of the day here. Matthew, let me throw it to you because they kind of interestingly dovetail, don't they? Matthew.
Yeah, they do. And I think when you get at the Green New Deal, Build Back Better ideology, it really comes down to something that is a little bit uncomfortably religious in its fanaticism. There has been a longstanding objective to try to decarbonize the world. We saw this at COP14 in 2009, a conference that was supposed to create a new type of global governance mechanism way back in 2009, right? That would be able to enforce nation states and have more power than sovereign nation states to force them to obey their carbon reduction quotas. That was sabotaged by India and China locking themselves up in a room and not participating in any of the proceedings of the conference. And they're trying this again now to essentially use the multifaceted crisis of the systemic breakdown, which is already happening even before the pandemic happened in 2019. There was a systemic crisis that was ripe to blow. Things have accelerated, and now the situation in Ukraine is being used again as an advantage to accelerate this idea of a post-hydrocarbon world that would be entirely reliant upon windmills, solar panels, no nuclear, which are ultimately things which destroy nations' capacities to have industrial civilization, the ability to sustain our 8 billion people at a certain population level and quality of life. That will be annihilated if these ideologues with their ivory tower mathematical models of what they think human population levels should be is permitted to go through. And Russia, China are absolutely having none of that. India is having none of that. They don't want to sacrifice their industrial civilization and their population on this altar. So we have a fight.
You know, Richard, you know, I'm not really interested, at least on this program, the merits of the Green New Deal or not. But it seems to me that it's a replication of the current system and it's the same winners and the same losers. OK, because it's being pitched as, you know, the brave new world, something completely different. But the way I look at it is that the shareholders in it, as it were, they're the ones that are going to win. They're the ones that are pushing this and they will profit from it. And I don't see anyone else. The Earth might profit from it. We don't know, okay? But it seems to be this is a way to push through an agenda that is not democratically discussed and voted upon. Richard.
Yeah, well, for me, the issue is put this way. If you want to deal with climate change and global warming, and you want to make a sustained assault on our dependence on something that is destroying us, you cannot omit the issue of the capitalist economic system, which has been the way this has been developed. This is a pretense. I understand why the people who want to advocate for a decarbonized system don't want to go there because it's dangerous. It gets you the enmity of all kinds of people who remain locked in a Cold War mentality where capitalism is good, socialism is bad, and all of that. But if you don't deal with the capitalist system, it will be the capitalist system that determines what portions of the Green New Deal ever get accepted, what form that acceptance takes, whose economic interests will be protected as that happens, and whose will be sacrificed. We've seen this over and over and over. Every technical change that we've had in 300 years has been premised on the notion, isn't it wonderful, because it'll make life less hard. We won't have to work long hours. Here we are 300 years later, we're still working crazy hours. We're still exhausted as a capitalist system, but we don't want to face that the ideas of improvement that don't deal with the underlying economic system that brought us this problem will not succeed. And until we overcome that problem, we will be spinning our wheels in the very way that prompts your question.
You know, Lou, I mean, we keep hearing that, you know, sacrifices have to be made. Sacrifices have to be made. I think in a most pitiful way for a democracy in Ukraine, which is just absolutely not true. It's empirically not true. But anyway, sacrifices have to be made to save the planet. But Lou, the same people that are saying that sacrifices have to be made don't make any sacrifices, do they?
No, of course they don't. And it's another fraud. It's a dangerous fraud. And it's, I must say, I'm one of those who likes capitalism, at least the real version, real capitalism. But I think that these people are totally evil. The people in Davos have, how shall I put this? They don't exactly have the American people or the European people or the African people or any other peoples in this world. They don't have their best interests at heart. They have their worst interests at heart. They want to demolish the economy. They want to make everything much, much worse. They really are the worst people on earth. Yeah. And we're supposed to listen to them, salute them, and do what they tell us to do.
Yeah, well, you know, Lou, the I always find it quite ironic in a very sinister way that these people, these ghouls, they gather every single year to solve the world's problems. But you know what? They are the problem. And so they arrive to solve problems that they create. And, oh, by the way, they profit from also. Matthew, one of the interesting things that is going on here is the Global South and watching their reaction to Washington and London's war drums against Russia. And, of course, you know, we have, you know, low-octane thinkers like Liz Truss, the foreign secretary. She's really ambitious. First it's Russia, then we go to China. I mean, these people are just detached from reality. The Global South is not. They understand what's going on, and they don't want to get involved in these ridiculous parlor games that Brussels and London and Washington are getting involved in. Go ahead.
No, you've said it. I mean, they've seen the fruits of what real globalization has been and what real imperial has been for a very long time. We've had it relatively easy and in our comfy little, you know, first world part of society in the transatlantic community, whereas these countries have faced hundreds and hundreds of regime change, assassinations, economic terrorism by the World the World Bank, the IMF, with, you know, 80 years of neocolonialism. So they understand what the system is actually wired around. So when you have a new game in town, and, you know, Russia, China, that entire Eurasian partnership, which increasingly has Iran, India on board, that operates on a completely different operating system founded upon long-term thinking, low interest rate loans that provide real growth for the real economy, not just making these countries debt slaves. They're going for it. And I think we have increasingly a lot of interest in many countries. Argentina is soon probably going to join the BRICS. We've got so many different points of connection with the Eurasian policy, the multipolar alliance with South America, with Africa, it's as well as Southwest Asia. It's there's a lot of points, I think, that keep a lot of ghouls, as you call them, up at night, hopefully having some healthy nightmares.
You know, Richard, again, I've talked to you a number of times about the immiseration of the middle class and working class people, and it's real now, okay? I mean, you have the war in Iraq, a war in Afghanistan, and talking heads like me can talk about it. But now we have a conflict in the center of Europe here, and it's people are suffering, not only in Ukraine, but working people all across the Western world. And the Western world prided itself on security and prosperity. It has neither right now. And my you know, the reason why I'm framing it this way is that what is the stress points now for working people? I mean, you know, I had a guest on a week ago. He said we could have $10 bread. I mean, that's not an impossibility. And it's working people that need gasoline. Okay, I mean, what is the stress point? Because we're going to get social instability, Richard.
We already have social instability. The way to understand it, and I'm talking here mostly about the United States, where I live and work, we have an amazing situation now. We have had 30 to 40 years of a systematic shift in the direction of greater inequality, right, economically in terms of income, economically in terms of wealth, and therefore politically in terms of who can buy political influence. All of that is on display, but it has really reached a peak in the last 3 years. Number one, we were hit by the pandemic. We were not able as a nation to deal with it very well. Hence, we have crossed the 1 million dead from COVID, a failure for a rich country with a well-developed medical system that remains to be faced. At the same time, the second worst crash of capitalism since the Great Depression. Here's a little statistic never to lose sight of. More than half of the American working class, half of what we call the labor force, an excess of 80 million American workers out of 160 million total, lost their jobs for part of the last 2 years, some for only a few weeks, some for the whole time. That is a cataclysmic blow. And then when that's behind you, barely, you have an inflation that is running now at 8 or 9%, way above the average rate of wage increases, and the Federal Reserve telling us we're going to have a recession as a result of rising interest rates to try to cope with the inflation. This is like the old joke about trying to stop a leaky dike by putting your finger in one hole only to see another one spurting out at you. We are in a position where the working class is suffering, and more it appears that whoever is running the show, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, an extreme rightist like Trump or Mr. Biden, nobody has a handle on what to do with it. And that's a very dangerous situation.
That's right. To sum it up, brace for impact, everybody. Brace for impact. Okay, gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Montreal, New York, and in Auburn. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.